Jefferson was in Paris as minister to France. There he learned that Louis XVI was sending out an expedition to the Pacific Northwest under the command of Jean-François de Galop, Comte de La Pérouse. The French government said the objective was strictly scientific, but Jefferson knew at once that La Pérouse was looking for something more than the Northwest Passage. He wrote on August 14th, "They, the French, give out that the object is merely for the improvement of our knowledge. Their loading and some other circumstances appear to me to indicate some other design, perhaps that of colonizing on the west coast of America, or perhaps to establish one or more factories there for the fur trade." He added that the real question was whether the French were yet weaned from their desire to have colonies in North America. Admiral John Paul Jones reported to him that they had not, that the La Pérouse expedition was preparing the way for French fur trade and colonization on the northwestern coast. The following summer, 1786, Jefferson met John Ledyard, who had sailed with Captain Cook and, as a consequence, was the first American to set foot in the Pacific Northwest. A born wanderer, a great talker, intense, dynamic, he convinced Jefferson that he could travel by land from Moscow to easternmost Siberia, cross the Bering Sea on a Russian fur trade vessel, then walk across the North American continent and eventually march into the capital to announce that he had arrived to report on the West. Ledyard proposed to do this with two dogs. Jefferson was supportive. Ledyard set forth. He made it to Siberia, where the absurd idea died when Ledyard was arrested by Empress Catherine the Great and sent back to Poland. La Pérouse, meanwhile, had sailed around South America, come up to the northwestern coast, taken observations and scouted for trading posts, and set sail for home. In January 1788, he made port in Botany Bay, Australia. When he left Botany, he vanished. The wreckage of his vessels was found 40 years later on an island north of the New Hebrides. In 1790, United States Secretary of War Henry Knox tried to mount a secret Missouri River reconnaissance. In Knox's view, an enterprising officer with a non-commissioned officer well acquainted with living in the woods and perfectly capable of describing rivers and countries, accompanied by 4 or 5 hardy Indians, would, in my opinion, be the best mode of obtaining the information requested. General Hosiah Harmar nominated Lieutenant John Armstrong for the command of the expedition, but warned Knox that it seems very much too adventurous. The governor of the Northwest Territory, Arthur St. Clair, was equally blunt. He told Knox, "It is, sir, I believe, at present, altogether impracticable." Lieutenant Armstrong gave it a try, but by the time he reached the Mississippi, he was ready to admit, "This is a business much easier planned than executed." Knox had said that the pocket compasses and pencils and papers would do for making maps and recording discoveries, a mark of how little he understood the problem. Armstrong, after reaching the Mississippi, made a list of items any exploring party would have to have, starting with oilcloth to secure the papers from the elements and including proper writing instruments and scientific tools for measurements. A tent would also help. He sent in his expense account. "For himself and servant, totaling $110.39 He never got to the west bank of the Mississippi. In 1792, Jefferson had another idea on how to explore the west. On May 11th of that year, the American sea captain Robert Gray had sailed his Columbia into the estuary of the Columbia River. Later that month, he met and traded information with Captain George Vancouver, who was making an official voyage of discovery of the Pacific coast for the British government. The discovery of the Great River of the West established the mouth of the Columbia at 124 degrees of longitude and the latitude at 46 degrees. From the results of James Cook's third voyage in 1780, Jefferson had a rough idea of the extent of the continent. With the Gray and Vancouver information, the knowledge was exact. The continent was about 3,000 miles wide. Jefferson was spurred, not depressed, by the information. He proposed to the American Philosophical Society of Philadelphia that a subscription be undertaken to engage an explorer to lead an overland expedition to the Pacific. Big donors, led by George Washington, Robert Morris, and Alexander Hamilton, came in on the subscription, ensuring its success. Washington's pledge came with a matching challenge. I readily add my mite to the project and do authorize you to place me among and upon a footing with the respectable sums which may be subscribed. With such help, by January 23, 1793, the American Philosophical Society was in a position to offer £1,000 to the explorer who could make it to the Pacific and back and report on what he saw. As noted, 18-year-old Meriwether Lewis volunteered to lead the expedition, but Jefferson passed him off as obviously too young and insufficiently trained. He chose instead the French botanist André Michaud. Jefferson wrote the instructions for Michaud and went over them with Washington. Since Hamilton and other officials were also involved, the instructions can be said to represent the motives, expectations, and hopes of the founding fathers toward the North American West, 10 years after independence was recognized in the Treaty of Paris and at the beginning of the second term of the Washington administration. The instructions were dated April 30, 1793. The first purpose, Jefferson wrote, was to find the shortest and most convenient route of communication between the U.S. and the Pacific Ocean within the temperate latitudes. Since that was almost certain to be the Missouri River, it has therefore been declared as a fundamental object of the subscription, not to be dispensed with, that this river should be considered and explored. Because the country belonged to Spain, not the United States, Michaud should cross the Mississippi somewhere far enough north of the Spanish garrison in St. Louis to avoid the risk of being stopped. He should then march west until he struck the Missouri, follow it to the mountains, get over them, and ascend the Columbia River to the Pacific. Beyond the search for the all-water route across the continent, Jefferson told Michaud that as he proceeded, he should take notice of the country you pass through, its general face, soil, river, mountains, its productions, animal, vegetable, and mineral, so far as they may be new to us and may also be useful, the latitude of places, the names, numbers, and dwellings of the inhabitants, and such particularities as you can learn of them. Jefferson had selected Michaud because he was a trained scientist. Botany, astronomy, mineralogy, and ethnology were among the subjects he had studied. Throughout, the instructions emphasized practical, useful knowledge. There was no hint of encouraging exploration for its own sake or merely to satisfy curiosity about what was out there. This was a true enlightenment venture. Geography was what most interested the subscribers. Ignorance of the country through which you are to pass and confidence in your judgment, zeal, and discretion, Jefferson wrote, prevent the society from attempting more minute instructions, and even from exacting rigorous observance of those already given, except, indeed, what is the first of all objects, that you seek for and pursue that route which shall form the shortest and most convenient communication between the higher parts of the Missouri and the Pacific Ocean. Beyond the fur trade and other commerce, beyond the acquisition of knowledge, Jefferson and the subscribers wanted to tie the two coasts together, using the Missouri-Columbia waterway to form the knot in order to create a continent-wide empire for the United States. It was a breathtaking vision. It had, however, an anticlimactic ending. Michaud got started in June 1793, but he had scarcely reached Kentucky when Jefferson discovered that he was a secret agent of the French Republic, whose chief aim was to raise a Western force to attack Spanish possessions beyond the Mississippi. At Jefferson's insistence, the French government recalled Michaud. Over the following decade, Jefferson neither spoke nor wrote about the West. Partly this was because he was so busy with politics and his other duties, but it had also become obvious that the West could not be explored by private subscription and that the federal government could not afford to sponsor an expedition. Further, conditions in the country to be explored were so totally unknown that there could be no agreement on how many men it would take, what they would need, how long it would last. But there was no hurry, for as long as Louisiana was in Spanish hands and Ohio River Valley pioneers had access to the wharves of New Orleans, the United States could afford to wait. Spain was old and decrepit, growing weaker each year. America was young and dynamic, growing stronger every day. The people who were going to transform the Mississippi Valley, from its source to New Orleans, into farms and villages would come from the United States, not from Spain. Time would come soon enough to take Louisiana from the hapless Spanish. In the spring of 1801, however, Jefferson learned of the secret treaties between France, read Napoleon, and Spain, read Napoleon's brother, that had transferred Louisiana from Spain back to France. It was called a retrocession. Jefferson was greatly alarmed. As he put it in one of his more famous passages, "There is on the globe one single spot, the possessor of which is our natural and habitual enemy. It is New Orleans, through which the produce of 3/8 of our territory must pass to market." As long as the Spanish were in possession, the United States was willing to wait before asserting sovereignty. But revolutionary France? Napoleonic France? Expansionist France? Never. Often derided as a hopelessly romantic Francophile, Jefferson was a hard-headed practitioner of real politic on this one. "The day that France takes possession of New Orleans fixes the sentence which is to restrain her forever within her low watermark," he warned, "because from that moment we must marry ourselves to the British fleet and nation." He let the French know of his resolve. He suggested that Napoleon cede Louisiana to the United States to eliminate the possibility of war between the former allies, a war which Jefferson warned would annihilate France on the ocean. And he flatly declared that his government would consider any attempt to land French troops in Louisiana a cause for war. That was the kind of blunt talk Americans liked to have their president use when it came to America's national interests in a clash with any foreign nation. Also persuasive was that it was based on facts. Napoleon's expeditionary force was being devastated in Santo Domingo. It was obvious France could not reconquer that colony, much less send an army to New Orleans. The British and Americans in combination would have sunk the French navy and merchant fleet. Napoleon could not defend what he owned. He could only lose in Louisiana. Why not give it to the United States and be done with the problem, and in the process reestablish the alliance between the two countries? But Napoleon had not become Emperor of France by giving things away. Though he agreed with the logic, he would rather sell than give. The Spanish, still in command in New Orleans, waiting for the French to arrive and take possession, had meanwhile withdrawn the right of deposit, the right to offload goods at the piers in New Orleans, sell them, and then reload onto sailing vessels. The immediate effect was minor. Americans could still offload directly from raft or keelboat to ships in the port or pay fees, and the Spanish gave a solid reason. Smuggling had gotten completely out of hand. But decisions about Louisiana could only be made by Napoleon. Jefferson instructed the American minister in Paris, Robert Livingston, to negotiate for a tract of land on the lower Mississippi for use as a port, or, failing this, to obtain an irrevocable guarantee of the right of deposit. To reinforce Livingston, Jefferson began working on a plan to send James Monroe over to Paris as a minister plenipotentiary with specific instructions for the purchase of New Orleans for $2 million. As he talked this up among Republican leaders, Jefferson indicated he would be willing to ask Congress for up to $10 million for New Orleans. And why not? It would be cheaper than a war, and quicker. It would keep America out of an alliance with the British, the very thought of which to these Revolutionary War veterans was mortifying. It would certainly be constitutional. There was no other single thing the federal government could do that would more exactly meet its charge to improve commerce. The thought that Napoleon might be willing to sell all of Louisiana had not occurred to anyone. It was not the French who got Jefferson to start another project for an exploring expedition across the West. The retrocession had nothing to do with it, but the British. Alexander Mackenzie was a young Scotsman in the fur trade out of Montreal, working for the Northwest Company. In 1787, he was posted to a wild trading post on the west end of Lake Athabasca, in what is now northern Alberta, at 60 degrees of latitude. Though he imported enough of the comforts of civilization to Fort Chipewyan so that it was called the Athens of the North, another part of him yearned not for what had been left behind, but rather what lay ahead. In 1789, he led a small party to Great Slave Lake. On the river that now bears his name, he set out for the sea. But the river swung to the north, and Mackenzie made tidal water on the shores of the Arctic Ocean, not the Pacific. Undeterred, the next year Mackenzie tried again. He wintered at the Northwest Company's westernmost post, Fort Fork, on the Peace River. From there, on May 9, 1793, he set out. Accompanying him was his fellow Scot Alexander Mackay, six French-Canadian voyageurs, and two Indians, plus a ton and a half of provisions. Within the month, he had crossed the continental divide at a place where it was just 3,000 feet high and easily portaged. Mackenzie reported to the Governor General of Canada, "We carried over the height of land, which is only 700 yards broad, that separates those waters. The one empties into the northern Atlantic Ocean, and the other into the western." Mackenzie got onto the Fraser River, which he mistakenly thought was the northern tributary of the Columbia, but abandoned it when it became impassable and struck out overland for the coast. 13 days later, he made it to saltwater in the northern reaches of the Strait of Georgia. He camped that night atop a steep, overhanging rock. Using a makeshift paint of vermilion and hot grease, he inscribed on the rock, "Alexander Mackenzie, from Canada, by land, the 22nd of July, 1793. The British had their claim on the Northwestern Empire. Mackenzie got the latitude and longitude of the place. He worked out the latitude using his sextant, which measured the height of the sun above the horizon. Knowing the moment the sun crossed the local meridian made it possible for him to compute how far north of the equator he was. Longitude was much more difficult, although easy in theory. The Earth turns 360 degrees every 24 hours without variation, meaning that the passage of time is also a measure of distance from some arbitrary starting point. By 1793, Greenwich, England, down the Thames River from London, was becoming firmly established as a conventional marker for zero longitude. In 4 minutes, the turning Earth moves 1 degree in longitude. It is relatively easy to calculate longitude if the explorer knows precisely when it is noon in Greenwich and what time it is where he is standing. But it is almost impossibly difficult to calculate longitude if you can't tell the time, in either Greenwich or the wilderness. Englishman John Harrison had invented a clock that was reliable and portable, making it possible to know both times. Captain James Cook had used the Harrison chronometer in the Pacific Ocean in 1775, proving its superiority. But the rigors of overland journeys were too much for such delicate instruments. They got banged around, they got dust in them, so land explorers relied on the telescope and astronomy. Mackenzie picked out Jupiter with his telescope and noted the time when the moons Io and Ganymede disappeared behind the planet. From tables showing the times of the same events from Greenwich, Mackenzie computed a longitude of 128.2 degrees west, which was almost a degree, or 40 miles, off. He realized he had been most fortunate. A few cloudy days would have prevented me from ascertaining the final longitude of it. Clouds were always the bane of the navigator. Back at Fort Chipewyan, Mackenzie tried to prepare his journal for publication, but he fell into a depression. His biographer writes that this was his second attempt to find a practical commercial route to the Pacific, and it was at least in part a failure. He had reached the Pacific, but he knew his route could not be used for trade. He left Canada that year and never came back. Mackenzie's account was not published until 1801 in London. It was probably ghostwritten, for Mackenzie was not learned enough to have written the book in its published form. The title was Voyages from Montreal on the River St. Lawrence through the continent of North America to the frozen and Pacific Ocean. Jefferson ordered a copy as soon as he heard of the book's existence, but did not have one in his hands until the summer of 1802. He was at Monticello, Lewis was with him, and when the book finally arrived, they devoured it. If the news that the British were exploring overland to the Pacific was a bit of a shock and most unwelcome, it was more than balanced by Mackenzie's evidence that, although there was only a one-day portage over a low mountain pass to a westward flowing river, that river was not navigable. But then Mackenzie had been 5 full degrees north of the Columbia when he struck the coast. If the mountains 400 miles south were similar to those he crossed, the portage would also be similar. In their minds, Jefferson and Lewis saw the Rockies as resembling the Appalachians in height and breadth. That image was greatly reinforced by Mackenzie. Geographer-historian John Logan Allen, in his seminal work, Passage Through the Garden, Lewis and Clark and the Image of the American Northwest, notes that Mackenzie said in effect that the way to the Pacific lay open and easy. According to Professor Allen, It was this simple fact of imaginary geography that gave birth to the Lewis and Clark expedition. Through those hot August days of 1802 at Monticello, Jefferson and Lewis read and talked about little else than Mackenzie. Although Mackenzie stressed that his had been a long, painful, and perilous journey, and although things had turned out badly for Mackenzie, Lewis saw a competitive challenge and an opportunity to act out his life's dream. Anything the British could do, he could do better. It was easy to point to mistakes or shortcomings in the Mackenzie expedition. He had been on a strictly commercial venture with a single purpose only, to find a practicable route for the fur trade. He had collected few specimens, made few descriptions, in general did not advance knowledge of the plant, animal, mineral, or Indian life of the country. Although nearly every sentence in the book was a magnet to Lewis, what struck hardest was the line, "Alexander Mackenzie, from Canada, by land." This raised the matter of national honor. The name painted on that rock on the Pacific coast was a direct, open, irresistible challenge. It was also a warning that if the United States did not get going, it would lose the Western Empire to the British before the game was well underway. The sentences that most struck Jefferson were in Mackenzie's final geographical review, in which he urged Great Britain to develop a land passage to the Pacific for trade with Asia. He knew it could not be the Fraser or any other river north of the Columbia, which was the most northern situation fit for colonization and suitable